Radio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm your host, Jason Dolt. And it's a big news day tonight on the local edition. We've got a lot of stories to get to. Stories on housing in the Hudson Valley. Also on New York State's ongoing less-than-smooth rollout of legal cannabis. We also have an update on Sharon Tony Finch, the New York veteran who spread a false story about homeless vets being displaced by migrants and asylum seekers last year. She has now been charged in federal court with fraud and stolen valor. I spoke to Philip Pantuso, managing editor of the Times Union, to go over all of these stories. And the reason that I spoke to him earlier today was because Philip was on his way to visit encampments at local colleges to report on ongoing protests there. This, as the Times Union reports this afternoon, more than 2,000 people have now been arrested in connection with protests on college campuses against the Israel-Hamas war nationwide. 2,000 arrests. So with that backdrop, before we're done tonight, Philip will give us a preview of his visit to the protest encampments at SUNY New Paltz and Vassar College. But we start tonight in Forestburg, where New York Attorney General Letitia James alleged last year that town zoning regulations were discriminatory, and town officials are now saying, essentially, no, they weren't. Here's Philip Pantuso.
This is kind of a long-running story, but a couple of weeks ago, the state attorney general's office warned leaders of Forestburg that zoning regulations they adopted last year, specifically for places of worship, may be discriminatory because they appear to have been designed to block a large development project proposed by developers with Hasidic Orthodox Jewish principles. So this comes... The Attorney General's intervention is coming as Forestburg town leaders and the developers have been battling in court. I said that this is kind of a long-running story. This court battle has been going on for 4 years, really ever since the developers bought the project, which is called the Lost Lake Resort, for $7 million. I think it was $13 million. And it had previously been approved to hold more than 2,000 residences in an area of 3 square miles. The developers filed a federal lawsuit earlier this year in U.S. District Court, alleging that Forestburg County officials sought to block them from developing that property by enacting what they described as burdensome zoning regulations that would require a minimum of 5 acres for places of worship and lot line setbacks that are far larger than what other similar building uses are required to meet. So that's been working its way through the courts. And the news here essentially is that the state attorney general's office seems to be siding with the developers, at least with their position. Earlier this week, Forestburg town leaders disputed the attorney general's office's claims about those regulations, saying that they in fact were not crafted to target the developers of the project and that there is no wholesale exclusion of religious uses from any district as the as Letitia James' letter claims. So this is, you know, it's just kind of the latest battle between town leaders and, you know, specifically Hasidic Orthodox Jewish developers. You know, we've seen this play out in this, you know, this is in Forestburg, obviously, but we've seen this play out with the Greens at Chester project in Orange County a few years ago. You know, I'm sure this won't be the last one.
And if you could just, this all hinges on discrimination against places of worship. And it sounds like this is a residential community, but I guess I would assume then there are places of worship within that community. Is that where these issues overlap?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is that the proposal will include a place of worship, which the town is saying means that it then needs to meet these new stricter zoning regulations. That's my understanding of the proposal.
Your article is saying, hey, the town of Forestburg's kind of firing back against the AG on this, pushing back. But ultimately, when it's the state AG and telling you to do something and you're a town and you're pushing back, that winds up in court, right? That's how these things get settled.
Well, yeah. And, you know, this is already in federal court. And it's going to get settled by, you know, a U.S. district court judge at some point. I don't know the timeline on that. The attorney general's office here, the state attorney general, she's essentially acting as she's sort of, it's not exactly like a friend of the court brief, but it's a similar type of role that her office is playing here, essentially lending what she would claim to be her expertise and certainly her office's opinion based on state law governing zoning and religious discrimination about whether or not these new regulations fall within, you know, legal bounds.
Okay, and you have an update on another long-running story that folks might remember. Sharon Tony Finch, the veteran who last year spread the fake story about homeless veterans being displaced by migrants. What's the latest on her story?
Yeah, people might remember this from just about this time last year, a crazy story that was first reported in the New York Post and then became national news for about a week, when New York City started busing migrants upstate. There was this claim that migrants that went to a hotel in Newburgh displaced homeless veterans under the care of a Orange County nonprofit called the YIT Foundation. And, you know, this is perfect outrage bait for national media, particularly, you know, Fox News and some of the Republican congressmen and state senators and assembly members. The main source for that story was a woman named Sharon Tony Finch. She was the CEO of the YIT Foundation. She is an Iraqi war combat veteran herself. And, you know, the Times Union, among other news organizations, was the first to debunk that story. We began looking at other claims that Sharon Tony Finch had made about her background. Namely, you know, Brendan Lyons was able to obtain her Army discharge papers, and there's no record there of her having received a Purple Heart, which is a claim she had made repeatedly to fundraise for her organization, to get disability benefits and other services from the Veterans Administration, and also to get recognition from the state. She was awarded a Woman of Distinction by the Senate last year. You know, her papers show that she is a veteran and that she did serve at least two tours in Iraq. But she claimed, you know, that she had had all of these traumatic injuries, had undergone 80-something surgeries, and again, you know, had that Purple Heart. Hard to check the health stuff, of course, but no record of the Purple Heart. The only sort of countervailing point of evidence there is that she is in the National Purple Heart Hall of Honor, which is in Orange County, and what you have to apply to be admitted to. You have to show your discharge paper showing that you have a Purple Heart. So we could never quite figure out, we could never quite square that contradiction. We did report last year that the Attorney General's office was looking into that claim. And yesterday we got news that Tony Finch had been charged with 4 counts of fraud in an indictment unsealed in federal court yesterday on Wednesday. Those charges include defrauding military charities and the Veterans Administration by falsely claiming to have received a Purple Heart. They also include stolen valor and forging a military discharge certificate. So basically what prosecutors here are alleging is that Sharon Tony Finch committed wire fraud by fraudulently fundraising based on her background and what she said she would do with the funds donated to her nonprofit. They allege that she, you know, spread misinformation about her service record and used funds that were donated to her nonprofit that she said would go to help homeless veterans, which is what her nonprofit does. Instead, she used those on personal expenses. You know, she also propagated this Purple Heart alleged lie in a number of avenues to get like benefits and services from military charities and the VA that she was not eligible for. And in order to do that, they say she forged her military discharge papers. Those are the papers that she would have submitted to the Purple Heart National Hall of Honor. And that explains why she's in there, even though they weren't in the papers that we were able to get from the Army itself. So a pretty wild turn in this story. And frankly, kind of a sad story, in my opinion. And my personal view on this, I've done a lot of the reporting on the homeless veteran story. It certainly seems like her nonprofit at one point did do some pretty important and certainly laudable work helping unhoused veterans in the area. And I'm not sure like how she got herself into this situation, but clearly, you know, something has gone awry and she kind of got in over her head with a lie that got too big.
Wow. All right. Yeah. And again, this was a local story that you were on top of that quickly became like a national story. So thank you for giving us that update. Now on to the good cause eviction. Kingston is among the cities in New York poised to opt into the state's good cause eviction. But, you know, Kingston and other Hudson Valley cities, you know, took a number of steps in recent years, especially following the pandemic, to help with housing issues. How is the state's good cause eviction different from what they've already been doing?
Yeah, so the state, as part of the sort of final budget process, passed the state version of good cause eviction that, frankly, it seems like tenants and their advocates and landlords are not really happy with. I can't remember if I talked about this last week or not, but basically, as you mentioned, Kingston, a number of other Hudson Valley cities, Beacon, Newburgh, Poughkeepsie, and then a little further upstate, Albany, all passed local versions of good cause eviction that have all been challenged in court, or in the case of Kingston actually rescinded their version to avoid a court challenge. The landlords are challenging these bills, which essentially provide limits on the reasons why or how a landlord could evict a tenant. It's supposed to be a tenant protection thing. And these kept falling in legal challenges with judges ruling that state law should take precedent here. So tenant advocates and state lawmakers shifted their efforts to passing a state law. The state version is a little, it's certainly less tenant friendly than what most of the local versions were. It only applies to certain rental units. If an apartment was built in 2009 or later, it's exempt for 30 years. Condos, manufactured homes, sublets, and dorms are also exempt. And small landlords are exempt as well, which the state version, which is essentially just like it's a mirror, it's a copy of a version that was passed in New York City. The state version defines small landlords as landlords who own 10 or fewer units in a building that they do not occupy. There's a bunch of other sort of stipulations as well. Like the law lays out units that are exempt based on how much greater the rent is than a fair market rate for, you know, the city or town that they're in. The upshot here is that the state version is an opt-in law. So it doesn't apply anywhere, basically, that doesn't opt into it. And so we wanted to take a look and see, okay, which of these cities that have passed a version of this law previously are going to opt into it. And it's unclear at this point how many will, but as you mentioned, Kingston said it would. The mayor there, Steve Noble, told our reporter, Joshua Solomon, that it's planning to opt in. And then what happens there is that when a city opts into the law, they can change certain versions of it. So, for example, I mentioned that small landlord threshold. You know, a small landlord, 10 units or more, that might work for New York City, but there are, I think there are landlords in a place like Kingston who might own 8 units or something, and that's not nothing for a small city, and for them to just be totally exempt, I think, is in violation of the spirit of the law. So I would be, I would expect that any of these upstate cities that opt into the law, the statewide version of good cause eviction, would lower that threshold to maybe something like 5 units or 6 units or something like that. And that's seemingly what Kingston is going to do as well.
Is this a done deal, or are they still thinking about it?
It's not a done deal. Noble, the mayor, said he expects the city to opt into it. They are going to bring it up at the next Common Council meeting. Kingston is one of the cities that already has kind of housing policy in place. It opted into the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. And as I've spoken about on this show many times, that has also gone through court challenges. But for the most part, courts are siding with tenants in the Emergency Tenant Protection Act because that actually is already a state law. And it's essentially now Good Cause is going to operate the same way that the Emergency Tenant Protection Act does, which is you take a New York City law, make it statewide, and then give upstate cities the chance to opt into it and sort of move the sliders as they will to fit their housing markets. So that's kind of how it's going to operate, it sounds like.
Okay, Philip, these are big stories that we're going over today with a lot of information. And if you don't mind, I just want to take a quick break so that we can come back and still get to the other stories we want to talk about. This is the Local Edition, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hi, I'm Bill Williams. Join me for the Kingfisher Project Tuesday on The Local Edition, where my guest will be Dr. James L. Baker, who will be talking about his new book, This Monstrous Obsession, Hard Lessons Learned About Addiction. That's the Kingfisher Project, Tuesday evening at 6. Only on The Local Edition.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Welcome back to The Local Edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole. Earlier today, I spoke with Philip Pantuso from the Times Union, going over a lot of news today. Let's return to that conversation. So, Philip, you're looking at Columbia County DA starting a conviction integrity unit, allowing anyone to appeal the DA's office to review their conviction. Is this coming out of any other stories that we've gone over before?
Nope. This is what the new DA, Chris Liberati Conant, said is basically just best practice for a modern prosecutor's office. That's what he told our reporter, Roger Hennigan Gilson. And it's kind of his flagship initiative since being elected last year. And it's pretty interesting. So this is a kind of internal unit to the district attorney's office called a conviction integrity unit. It doesn't have its own staff. The seven assistant district attorneys will sort of take turns reviewing applications as they come in. And basically, anyone who believes that they or a family member has been wrongly convicted can request the DA's office to review the case by downloading a form from its website. That begins this two-step process. First, an assistant DA is assigned to review the case and determine if there are legitimate questions regarding the evidence. And if there are questions, the assistant DAs will begin what he called a deeper dive into the case, which could eventually result in the DA asking the court to dismiss the conviction. This is the 14th conviction integrity unit at the county level in New York, which has 62 counties. And these kind of work in In broadly similar ways, although Roger kind of looked at how some bigger counties operate compared to smaller counties like Columbia County. So, for example, Brooklyn, Kings County has its own conviction integrity unit. They have its own staff, and they've exonerated 500 people since establishing that unit back in 2014. In the Hudson Valley, Putnam County has one, and Ulster County does as well. Although Ulster County's conviction integrity unit has not actually overturned any cases since it was established in 2019.
Is there any reaction from law enforcement in Columbia County, specifically the sheriffs?
They didn't have anything negative to say about it for this story. You know, I think the rubber will meet the road when there's actual cases to review. I think Liberati Connaught told us that they've gotten maybe one application so far, but they haven't actually moved forward. They're still just in the review phase. They haven't really moved forward on whether there are any questions in the evidence, and certainly there have not been any convictions overturned yet.
Okay, and there's a Saugerties woman who is seeking a marijuana cultivation and processing license, and now she's filing a lawsuit. What is she looking for?
Yeah, I can keep this one pretty brief. This is basically just the latest legal challenge to the state's marijuana regulatory framework. This woman filed this lawsuit saying that the Office of Cannabis Management changed the licensing application rules last year in what she called an arbitrary and capricious manner and without informing the public. And the several other legal challenges before this one, it questions rule changes that state officials made outside the boundaries of the law and that informed the creation of the retail marketplace regulatory framework. Her complaint basically contends that the change allows for up to 3 duplicate applications to be submitted and that wasn't disclosed to the public and that essentially prejudices her ability to obtain this license. So we'll see how far this goes. I think that the main takeaway with these legal challenges to New York's cannabis regulations is that for however well-intentioned the original law was, at the time, the thing that everybody said was that this law seems to be saying all the right things about who it's going to prioritize, how it's going to be rolled out. You know, they were going to first start with people who were just as impacted. They were going to have this kind of staggered rollout of licenses, right? They were going to try to prioritize small farmers, people who had been affected by the war on drugs, et cetera. But that was all in the original law, but the game plan for how to actually execute that was just punted into the future. And of course it took much longer to actually come up with, you know, a nuts and bolts plan for implementing the law, which is why we're still seeing this delayed rollout. And, you know, over that time, the makeup of the state legislature changed, people's political positions changed, people started getting donations from various interest and advocacy groups here, lobbyists started going to Albany all the time, and you know, we've kind of been trying to build the plane, or New York State's been trying to build the plane while it's flying it with regards to setting up the retail cannabis marketplace. And in doing so, they have just kind of missed things that, I think not paid attention to certain details. And this is another example where that's the case. And these legal challenges basically are forcing the state to go back in and kind of clarify certain language, certain provisions, and sort of do stuff it probably should have done 5 years ago.
That's really the whole thing. There's a lot of people that are not happy with this rollout, whether it was a lack of certified dispensaries, you know, from cultivators to purveyors, all the way up to Governor Kathy Hochul. I've heard a lot of frustration, both out in the open and you know, anecdotally, as you talk to people in the community. The legal side of this is forcing the state to buckle down and really define some of these aspects and how they work on the ground. Do you don't know what's going to happen, but the question I ask is it going to continue to be this haphazard sort of fixing as we go sort of thing, or will there be a moment of reckoning for the state and or the Office of Cannabis Management? Is there a groundswell coming?
That's a hard question to answer. Presumably, one hopes that they, over time, as they address more of these inconsistencies in the regulatory framework, there will be, you know, fewer to address in the future. The other thing that has changed, particularly, you know, we saw this with there were lawsuits last year challenging the sort of staggering of licenses and who had priority. A lot of those ended up being moot in the end because the state eventually opened up the licenses to all applicants or applications, sorry, to anybody. I do think, is there going to be a reckoning? I'm not sure. And I'm not sure exactly what that would look like. I do think that the more time passes, the more the regulatory framework will be fine-tuned, whether that's the OCM has more meetings to address certain inconsistencies or via the legal process. It's definitely better now, I think, than it was a year ago. You're seeing more dispensaries open, and they're opening at a faster pace. More people are able to apply for all types of licenses now than was the case 12 to, 18 months ago. But it's certainly, not exactly the playbook that any other state should want to follow.
Yeah. Well, Philip, I want to thank you for going over all this. But, I want to point out to the listener that we're recording this earlier in the day because you're about to go out and cover a local story that's getting a lot of national coverage. You're going to go to some protest encampments at local universities.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody's aware, I'm sure, of the large, pro-Palestine encampments that have formed on college campuses, really across the United States. This week, we've had two that have grown to include more than 100 students each, that have formed at SUNY New Paltz and Vassar. And they, the students there are making various demands about, mostly focused on trying to get their respective universities to divest their endowments from companies that manufacture weapons or that do business in Israel or that support settlements in the West Bank, things like that. So far, all indications are that these have been peaceful. I don't think police have really been involved in either case, but I'm going to go to both of them this afternoon and sort of check things out and talk to people on the ground. So look for a story on that probably tomorrow.
Okay, great. Well, best of luck with that. And I'll remind folks that all the stories that we've been talking about are up now at timesunion.com. Phil Pantuso, thanks again for talking to us.
Thanks. Take care.
Well, big thanks once again to Philip Pantuso for going over all of that news with us tonight. A lot of news stories tonight here on the Local Edition. But now the show is done, and I want to thank you so much for listening. I've been your host, Jason Dole. Do keep listening right here on air, live streaming at WJFFradio.org. Just ask your smart speaker to play Radio Catskill. Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, we got Ramble Tamble with John and Claire. Before that, The Daily is next. This is Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJF.